Nothing around here to be afraid of, I hope.
What was that? Shortwave. Take it down, quick. What's it say? Ah, shut up.
All right, it's Dave back with you on 720 WGN. So the longest-running horror movie show on television is Fanguli on MeTV. And tonight, a big announcement was made on his show. He's moving on up to a new time slot. And joining us to talk about it all is the legendary award-winning Rich Kos himself. What's up, buddy?
Legendary? Are you
legendary.
Kidding me?
Yes, you are. To me and millions.
Isn't that a kind of camel? No, wait, that's dromedary. Okay.
Wait, what? I got to tell
you. Too many mummy movies. I don't know.
I am so excited. Big, big announcement tonight. Drum roll, please. Rich, the big announcement, in case you didn't hear it tonight.
The Svengoolie Show is moving earlier on MeTV on Saturday nights. We're moving from what has been 10 o'clock Eastern and Pacific and 9 o'clock Central down to 8 o'clock Eastern and Pacific and 7 o'clock here in Chicago in the Central Time Zone.
Oh, man, I got to tell you, I am thrilled to hear that. I mean, I just think that exposes the audience to just a much larger audience. And because my kids love watching it, and I think I told you this before, they can never get through it all because it's so bad. No, I mean, they can never get through it all because it's so late. Because it's so late. And you know, we end up watching it like the next night or the next morning or whatever, or sometime during the week. Now I love that they're going to be able to watch it live. What happens? I love it.
Yeah, we've even heard the same thing, not just from kids, but from adults as well, who say, I love the show, but I start to, you know, fall asleep. Not everybody, you know, has that night owl in them anymore and can stay up until 11 o'clock. So we think a lot of people are going to get a chance to see it and maybe be a little more wide awake during it.
No, I love that. Well, especially on East Coast time. I mean, you think about that; it's midnight when the show's wrapping up. So it's going to be great to have you at 7 o'clock Central, especially here in Chicago. So when you first started the original show back in the late 70s, it was Saturday nights at 8, right?
Yeah, it was Saturday nights, and they moved it then down to afternoons. And then they kind of ping-ponged it around a lot. They moved it down at one point to 10 in the morning. And then that was not well accepted by the viewers. So they moved it back. And, you know, it moved around quite a bit. But we in the time I've been here starting at WCIU, it moved around a little bit, too. But, you know, we've been on MeTV in the evening for quite a while now.
Yeah.
And just going a little bit earlier, I think, is certainly going to, as you said, expose us to a lot more people and make it a little easier for some people to watch.
Congratulations on that. And you just also signed a new contract through 2035. My God, which is incredible. That's fantastic. Hello?
2035? That's how much my suit costs.
Nice. Nice. So, you know, throughout all this, and I'm excited about this, I'm looking at the new TV season. I love that it's launching, I believe it's September 9th. Is that Saturday, September 9th? Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, so it's going to do, like, it's the first big Saturday after Labor Day, and it's also the new TV season. And this is what I also love about this, Rich, is Saturday nights at 7 o'clock, there's nothing on.
Well, there's always some sports-type stuff, but there's a lot of people who don't necessarily get into the sports, and, you know, we'll provide a little entertainment for them at that early segue.
But, you know, Saturday nights used to be the prime night of television. That was the big night of the week when you think about it when we were growing up. It was Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart and all the family and MASH and all that other good stuff. It was the Love Boat and Fantasy Island after that. But Saturday nights were always a big night, and the networks don't really program to that anymore. And that's the one night most people are home. So, I think that's a great great bit of news that you'll be on at 7.
Yeah, I think so, too. And you're right. It seems like a lot of times the networks will use Saturday night almost as a dumping ground. And they'll just rerun a show that they're hoping people will catch up on a Saturday that runs during the week anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, or, you know, God forbid, another Steve Harvey show.
Exactly. Exactly. So NBC just announced, so as we're talking about fall schedules and new shows coming on, that they're going to put together a reboot of The Munsters, which I believe, I'm going to read this to you, inspired by the original series, the half-hour single-camera Munsters, now in development, follows members of an offbeat family who are determined to stay true to themselves, but struggle to fit into hipster Brooklyn. NBC and Universal, and there's your tie-in right there, they own the rights, obviously, to The Munsters. They tried to reboot this, I think, back in 2012 as something called Mockingbird Lane, and it didn't go over very well. I just don't understand why we don't leave well enough alone and celebrate these shows as they are. These reboots, to me, never work.
I agree with you on that, Dave, and that includes some of the ones that have been rebooted into movies. I think, for one thing, The Munsters, we've all been so exposed to the original, and we know it so well, and the characters, that when you start making changes in them, and they're obviously played by other actors because the previous right. actors are not available anymore.
No, they're not.
And even if you remember, there was the remake.
Oh, wait a minute. Eddie's always available, Rich. Eddie's available at any moment to reprise that role.
I know. Yeah. Do you have a hat? Drop it. He'll show up.
Anyway, go ahead.
Do you remember when they did The Munsters Today with John Shuck as Herman?
Yeah, I think I watched one, and then I was like, this isn't it. This isn't the original.
And that was it. It was trying to be pretty faithful to the original, and, you know, it just didn't fly because, again, it wasn't those original people.
Yeah.
You have to give some credit to it. It's not just casting a role. It's the actual people that made those characters work. And that obviously didn't catch on. And same thing when you got, what was it, 13 Mockingbird Lane or whatever it was called. It was, again, they already had the characters kind of removed from what the original characters were. And that only diluted it more. And now, you know, they're going to be, matching wits with hipsters in New York. It's like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, they're so known. And as we know, a lot of these actors were so defined by those characters, they were never able to get a lot of great roles after they played those roles. But they're so identified with them to see someone else step into those roles. I just don't see it. And I wondered, is it that there's people like our age that just want to remake it? They know it might not fly, but it's just cool to rebuild the sets and kind of recapture that and be a part of it, knowing it might not. I just don't get it. It's none of them work.
Well, I think that's part of it. It's just these people now are in positions of power, and they remember something that they just absolutely loved. And if you give them the chance, it's like, hey, here's a chance for you to do that show. It's like, this is great, but then they start bringing their own sensibilities into it, which may or may not be correct. And I don't know. You know, and again, I said it before, we're just so used to the originals.
Yeah.
It's like, just like the Honeymooners.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine anybody else being Ralph Cramden or Ed Norton?
Of course not. Well, Cedric the Entertainer, I could imagine probably doing that. Hello?
But he'll talk to you about diabetic nerve pain.
That's
and, you know, Ralph never spoke about that.
He never did that. But, you know, when I hear, Will and Grace being rebooted, but it's with the original cast, and so it's kind of more of a 10-episode reunion, or Roseanne, or What's Happening Now. No. They're not.
You tried to fool me there.
I did. But those I'm kind of okay with. And actually, Norman Lear rebooted One Day at a Time on Netflix, and it focuses around a Hispanic family. He probably could have called it anything, and
sure.
It would have flown because it's actually pretty well written, and it's the storyline is pretty indicative of its time. I guess he just dug into the past and wanted to use the old name with a similar premise. I'm even okay with that, but some of these, right, the characters that were so, you know, iconic, or even a little bit more on the science fiction side, when you think about the Gilligan's Islands and the Genies and the Bewitched, when they try to redo Bewitched some years ago, that stuff just doesn't fly.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dave. And again, I think a lot of it is, you know, those actors that played the original parts, and a lot of, you know, today's actors haven't gone through the same things. How else can I put it?
Yeah.
They haven't had the same experience. in the same era that those original actors had.
Sure.
Because it was a whole different formative practice back then. Back then, there were no internet stars.
No, right.
Or, you know, people who are mediocre, but just because they're on TV, they get a lot of roles.
Well, it's just because the Three Stooges movie, let's talk about that came out. I saw it because I felt like I had to see what they were doing with it for more of that reason, but I really had no interest to go see it and embrace it as if it was the next generation of those characters. And they weren't even characters. They were themselves kind of playing just goofy guys. But, you know, I couldn't even see that happen. I'll watch the original all day long. I'll never watch that movie again.
Yeah, and that's funny because what that reminds me of is the fact that the guy playing Mo, sure, he was doing it, but you can tell it was a guy trying to play Mo, and it wasn't just his natural reactions and sensibilities that, you know, I know I'm talking about the Stooges like they're Shakespeare, but really, that was
I'm okay with that.
You know, it was these people's personalities and their reactions were the honest reactions they had to things.
Yeah.
And did you hear that they're trying to do, I think there's a Kickstarter for it, they want to do the Little Stooges?
Oh, God, no interest in that. Just stop. Don't give any money to them, Rich.
I know, not me. I know there was a comic book kind of thing like that was done by Moe's son-in-law, Norman Mahler.
Yeah.
Because he was a cartoonist, and he drew a couple of these. I think they had a short-run comic book with that. And maybe that's where this came from, that, you know, the family thinks, well, remember that, we came up with that, let's try that. And I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to fly either. But these comedy teams back in the day, and I'm going to segue a little bit here, talk about a little bit the Three Stooges. There was Laurel and Hardy. There was the Marx Brothers. Some people want to lump in there Hope and Crosby, Martin and Lewis, and some of these other guys as well. But there wasn't a lot, you know, if you look back today, that's still relevant today and still gets airplay, and that's Stooges and Abbott and Costello.
Yeah, that's very true. You see a few maybe Martin and Lewis ones occasionally.
Yeah.
And again, you know, they were the hottest thing in show business at one point, and yet you don't really see them on a regular basis, I don't think. The Stooges, there's something about them that just appeals to so many people. And, you know, when kids see it, it's like, to them, I think it's almost like it's a live-action cartoon.
Yeah.
And they're so used to that sort of thing. It's amazing to me that those have held up so well. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the Stooges, and I can sit there and watch the same ones over and over again and have done that.
Even the Joes?
Yeah, sure.
You know what? It's always funny. You don't want to. It's almost like people who, and I'm gonna compare this, and this is gonna sound like an awkward comparison, but I think that people actually deep down that support Trump in some way will never tell you they do for fear of being judged in some way. I think that's the same about the Three Stooges. I don't think anybody will really tell you they're big fans of the Three Stooges, and like you're someone like you and me. Larry Word, it was his birthday, I don't know, a couple months ago, and I sent him The Stooges, We Baked You a Birthday Cake in a video.
Uh-huh.
And I would say for half the afternoon, it was quips going back and forth via text of one-liners from the Three Stooges, because you just don't know. There's fans everywhere out there.
There really are. And it's always great to see them. And, you know, I wish we could get rights back to it, because we'd all love to do Stoogiepalooza again, the show that I did where we'd highlight some of the shorts every week.
I miss that show. And you and this is what we're going to do tonight, folks, is Rich and I, we got to figure out who the next person we're going to talk to together. But, you know, when I had the opportunity back when I think it was the 80th anniversary of the Stooges shorts at Columbia or whatever it might have been, and 80th anniversary of Abbott and Costello, I invited Rich because I know Rich is the expert on all this, all things Stooges, and obviously Abbott and Costello, which with the shows, of course, he airs on Svengoolie, and we had a really good time some years ago talking to Joan Moore, which was Moe's daughter, and to Chris Costello, who was Lou's daughter, and they just had different insights on life with their famous dads.
And both of them were so nice and so willing to talk about it, and the fact that, you know, I think we brought up a couple things that maybe you know, might have been controversial in their families even, and they were more than happy to talk about it and set us straight on their viewpoints on it. So it was, they were both very honest, as well as just being very, very kind to us and talking to us.
Well, and when you think, too, how long these both these people have been gone. I mean, Moe's been gone since 1975, almost 40 years. Costello, I think, died in 59, didn't he? Like he was in the 50s yet.
Yeah, he really passed away at an early age. So, but again, the interest is there in these people. You know, they've withstood the test of time, certainly.
Well, we're going to share highlights from both these conversations over the next hour, which will be a blast, talking about these legendary comedy teams once again. So again, thrilled for you, Rich, that again, Saturday, September 9th, Svengoolie moves. Let me try that again. So again, Rich, so again, beginning Saturday, September 9th, Svengoolie moves to a brand new time slot, 7 Central on MeTV. And what are the shows that are coming up for you?
Okay, coming up next weekend, Bela Lugosi in Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Ooh.
Which is a fascinating early 30s movie. Along, you got giant gorillas, you got Bela, you can't beat that.
Nope, right.
And then on September 2nd, a good 50s one, Monster on the Campus. Do you remember that one where...
Sounds like a good back-to-school movie.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
It's back-to-school time, so why not bring a monster? They have a sample of some sort of prehistoric fish, and one of the professors gets contaminated by it and gets it into his bloodstream. Hence comes the monster on the campus.
Lovely. That sounds fabulous. And that's in the old time slot.
Yeah, then the new time slot on the 9th, we've got something a little bit different. It's a Gladiator movie. Do you like Gladiator movies?
Oh, yes, I do. Well, I'll tell you.
It's Son of Hercules versus the Medusa.
Oh. Nice. So tell me about that, because I have never seen it.
Oh, it's from that era where, you know, after Hercules was a big hit in the 50s, everybody was making these gladiator-type movies. And many of them were made in Italy, and even though it's supposed to be Grecian gods and such, it's Italy. And you have monsters in this stuff, and the gladiators fighting each other, and... it's actually pretty funny. Of course, they're dubbed, and there's only one American actor in it, and I think his lines were probably still dubbed in later because of the way that they do films over in Europe, or used to do them at least, where they wouldn't record the soundtrack. Everybody would just dub the soundtrack at a later time. So it's got everything. It's got a dragon. It's got the Medusa. And
that's
the
awesome.
Medusa is a little different from, you know, what we expect with the woman with the snakes in its hair. So you have to tune in and see what exactly the Medusa is.
And that is September 9th, Saturday, September 9th at 7 Central on MeTV. And then, of course, you can always get great Svengoolie apparel, posters. Love the poster, by the way. And so much more. You can visit... Svengoolie.com, and I also suggest, if you haven't already, sign up for the newsletter, because it's always, I always look forward to getting it every month, Rich.
Oh, that's great. And yeah, and you can see I write a blog at least once a week that talks about the movie, and there's videos on there. There's Kerwin's Corner, in which he reads the joke of the week.
Right.
And a lot of stuff on there, so please make sure you stop by it on your computer.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
All right, we're going to look back at my conversation with Rich and the Three Stooges, Mo Howard's daughter, and the daughter of Lou Costello, after the news next on 720 WGN.
You are listening to station WGN. Our Memorial Day musical program continues.
It's a radio. Turn it off.
It's Dave Player along with Rich Coase, live from the Allstate Showcase Studios on Chicago's very own 720 WGN, joining us to share her memories of her father, Mo Howard, and her famous uncles, Curly and Shemp, and great family friend Larry, along with eight decades of laughter. And by the way, I saw Joan appear on Late Night with David Letterman in the early 80s talking about the Fame Trio, as she's authored many best-selling books about them, including the Three Stooges scrapbook, the Three Stooges book of scripts, and a few short months ago updated and released her book, Curly, an illustrated biography of the Super Stooge. So please welcome Joan Maher, the daughter of Mo Howard of the legendary Three Stooges, to the program. Hello there, Joan.
Hi, David.
So tell me about your dad, Mo, you know, his parents, all of his siblings, because I know he had more brothers than just Shemp and Curly. You know, what was it like growing up in Brooklyn right around the turn of the century?
Well, anyway, Mo really had to go through hell with his haircut. The original haircut was not the Beatle look. It was long curls. They called them finger curls. His mother, who had five sons, wanted a daughter so badly that Mo became, at least Mo's head of hair, became the daughter. And he went through hell going to school. The kids would tease him, and he got used to that after a while. And he spent wonderful times on the beach playing his ukulele with his friend Ted Healy. He met him in his youth, and my dad loved to swim. He was a lifeguard. Mo never graduated from high school, but he loved to read, and he was a very well-educated man.
He was like the middle. Shemp was the oldest. Curly, Jerry was the youngest. He had brothers Jack and Irving as well, right?
Right. They were Metropolitan Life Insurance salesmen, and the mother felt that actors as sons, that was really terrible.
Well, you don't hear much about Jack and Irving Howard, so I would think that maybe she was wrong on that one.
Right.
What did your dad do, or what did your grandfather do for a living?
Well, he was very inept. It's lucky he had his wife, Jenny. Whatever he tried to do, he failed at. He preferred religious things, reading the Bible. His first job was being a peddler. I don't know who chose that. And he'd wander around the streets with trinkets, and in the box of trinkets was matches. And one time, I think he leaned against a wall of a building, and the box went up in flames. And the sad ending to that was somebody inside the building thought they'd put out the fire, and they threw a bowl of slop, if you know what that is, at him.
Oh, my. You know, Joan, I remember your grandfather made an appearance in one Stooge short, didn't he? Was it Disorder in the Court, where he's one of the people sitting in the courtroom?
The jury or the courtroom?
I don't think he was in the jury. I think he was just in the gallery watching.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing that short and seeing him sit there. I guess my father wanted him to get into the act.
I guess so. Well, early on, so Mo, you know, developed an interest in the movie business really when he was an early teen. And I know he played hooky a lot. And he started his first job in the business running errands at the Vitagraph studio in Brooklyn. And it was during the silent film era. And this is Vitagraph, by the way, was one of the biggest studios of its time. It was started in 1897. It was later sold to Warner Brothers in 1925. Big stars of the day. And he was running errands there because he so wanted to be part of the business.
Yeah, I'd heard that story. He started as a delivery boy, and then he'd get roles in these films as a bully. He was like a pint-sized mean Mo from the shorts.
That's funny. In his autobiography, which, by the way, I really enjoyed reading, he talks about getting a job with an acting troupe on a showboat, and what he did was he sent in a picture of an older, handsome neighbor who I guess had done some modeling or something to the captain who was in charge of the showboat show. And I think that really shows how he had such a drive to get into show business.
Exactly. And he got into a little bit of trouble with that because the captain, when he took one look at my dad and realized that he spent all this money on a railroad fare, he handed him a mop and he said, well, at least you can clean the floor. That went on for the first year. And then the next season that he went on the riverboat, he did get a chance to do some parts in the different plays they had.
Well, what's a shame is that all these shorts that he was in the silent era, and actually even the ones that his brother Shemp was in, they're all gone. There was a fire, I think, at the studio at Vitagraph, and all these shorts that he was in are long gone.
Right.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
That was sad. But there's so many things left that we should be thankful for.
Yeah, absolutely. So on March 19th, 1934, Mo signed with Columbia on behalf of Larry and his youngest brother, Jerry. And on May 5th, their first short was released. It was The Women Haters, Rich, tell us a little bit about the scenario of this short.
It's kind of interesting because this was a Columbia short that wasn't necessarily a part of the original set, if we want to call it that, of the 190 Stooge shorts. It was originally part of a group called the Musical Novelties. I think it was the sixth one in that. And they were all these sort of musical type shorts.
And isn't it because they signed them for like one short, and if that went well, they do the rest of the seven. So they probably didn't spend a lot of money on focusing on developing them. They kind of threw them into what was already existing.
Yeah, I think so. They plugged them into it, and they fit them into these roles because they're not really playing the normal, you know, Larry, Moe, and Curly. Yeah, Larry was Jim, and Moe was Tom, and Curly was Jack.
Yeah.
So it's Jim, Tom, and Jack. Yeah. It sounds like they're the Pep Boys or something.
And
what happened was they play guys who are just fed up with women. They're sick of them, so they join the Women Haters Club, and they decide they're going to swear off all women. But Larry is engaged, and Moe and Curly tell him, go break it off. But when he tries to at a big party, there's like threats of bodily harm, literally, from the girl's family, and that kind of makes him back down. And he ends up getting married right there on the spot. And then the rest of the short involves all three of them on the train. And it's supposed to be taking Larry and his bride on their honeymoon, but he's trying to hide the fact that he's married, and all three of the guys at times are kind of betraying their pledge to swear off women by flirting with Larry's bride. And
which
a
is
cool
nice.
Thing, well, yeah, I'm sure good friends always do that. And a nice thing in this is you get to see another Hollywood great in this. Walter Brennan has a bit part as a train conductor who gets interested in the Woman Haters Club.
Huh. I did not know that. And here's the odd thing, Joan, too, is that it was one of those actually very rare moments that, you know, Moe was obviously the lead of all this and he was the heavy and all that good stuff. But Larry was the romantic lead and the star of the short, really.
Yeah, I noticed that when I saw it rerun on television.
Yeah, he was the focus.
And a lot of the dialogue was done in rhyme. It was a very different Stooge comedy.
Yeah, people often note that to me, that they say, wow, are they actually, like, you know, doing these things like little poems and things like that, and then singing the main tune that was the theme of it, My Life, My Love, My All, and each one of the guys gets a chance to do their version of it, which is kind of cool.
It was very different, but it was fun to watch.
It was, absolutely. And, you know, there were always the standard characters that played in the Stooges shorts that, you know, I could even name them by name by seeing their names on the bottom of the screen all the time. Mm-hmm. This was the introduction, though, of Bud Jameson. Rich, tell me a little bit about Bud.
Yeah, he was a huge guy. He looked like he was a big, burly fellow.
Yeah.
And in this short, if you've ever seen it, he's the head of the Woman Haters Club who indoctrinates the Stooges into it. And he was a stock player not only with Columbia, but he worked at a lot of different studios and a lot of top comedy names besides the Stooges. He worked with Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chase. And he was a Christian Scientist and a diabetic. And when he became ill, suffering from kidney cancer in 1944, he refused treatment because it was against his religion. And sadly, he passed away at age 50. But he had such great comic timing. And he was always hilarious, whether he was a cop or he was some authority figure or their boss or whatever.
It was him and it was Vernon Dent.
Vernon Dent, who often would play the same types of parts. And again, they were these guys who were in charge. But, you know, it seemed like the Stooges were a little afraid of him, but they still managed to screw up and get their ire.
Joan, there was some women, obviously, that made some routine, you know, appearances in the Stooges shorts as well.
Right. Well, Simona Boniface was this society lady that
yes.
always got a pie in her face.
Yes, exactly.
And then the other, you know, her name went out of my head.
Christine McIntyre.
Christine McIntyre, very pretty blonde.
Beautiful.
She did a lot of shorts with Shemp, too.
And actually, there's a Chicago connection to her, too, because I think she attended one of the big music schools here in Chicago, and she had the beautiful operatic voice, and she got her training here at a school in Chicago as well.
There was one scene in one of the films where she's actually singing. She's doing the voice of somebody supposedly singing opera. If that was Christine, a beautiful voice.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Now, here's what's interesting. So, you know, just after their first short was released for Columbia, MGM still had one Three Stooges short, or a Ted Healy and a Stooges short, that they released 7 days after Columbia released theirs. And, again, Columbia signed them for one short with an option to do eight, and it was very successful. And they went on to their next short called Punch Drunks, which they actually played themselves. Rich, a little synopsis on that one.
Well, I've often heard that this was really the short that cemented the Stooges' contract with Columbia because it was so good and so successful. And I think part of that is the fact that the story is actually credited to the Stooges themselves. And it's funny because the boys start out separately at a restaurant at the beginning. Moe's a fight manager who's dining with his fighters. Larry comes in as a traveling musician who's going to provide dinner music in exchange for a bowl of soup. And Curly is a waiter who gets there late and isn't doing his job right. So Moe and the guys get mad at him and are beating him up for poor service. And while that's going on, Larry just decides to add some music. He plays Pop Goes the Weasel, which for some reason just triggers Curly to become like a dynamo. And he gets totally like the Incredible Hulk and starts beating up all of the burly boxers in Moe's stable. So Moe decides, hey, I'm going to train him to be my main fighter, and he needs Larry to come along so that he can play the weasel tune to get him infuriated. And then along the way, while they're fighting their way to the top of the fight game, there's another woman who appears that all three boys try to woo. And
as always.
Yeah, and they must have liked to try to get at the same women. And in Curly's biggest championship bout, Larry's violin gets smashed, and it's funny because he spends the rest of the short racing around trying to find ways to provide the weasel tune so that Curly doesn't get pulverized. And I've often said this is one of my absolute favorite shorts. It's just, from moment to moment, just packed with so much funny stuff.
Yeah, I remember doing the using the premise of that in one of my books, and I was surprised to find out that my dad had written the first draft of that, a handwritten draft, but it was quite different than the film. It just had a thread of the story in it. And like when Curly hears a certain tune, he goes nuts and knocks everyone in the vicinity out. But then the writers at Columbia really refined it and made it into a fine, fine film.
I think I read somewhere that, in fact, they weren't going to originally use Pop Goes the Weasel. They were supposed to use some other tune, but because it was a copyrighted tune, they didn't want to have to pay for the usage of it. So instead, they went with Pop Goes the Weasel.
That sounds like here.
Yeah, they did that in a lot of spots. Otherwise, it would have cost them a fortune.
Sure.
Now, did Moe and the boys, or was it primarily Moe, did he actually have... did he actually write some of this stuff? Did he actually get a say, or were the writers really the guys that pulled all this off?
Well, there was a script for each short, and it was really a detailed script. The only time they didn't put things in detail is when they would be knocking each other around and just say the Stooges do their stuff. But the way that there was a script meeting, I don't think Larry ever went to one, nor did Curly. My dad was so interested in what was going on, he would always be there. The writers would come up with either a headline in the news, like it had to do with the war, and then they'd do a script or a story about a war. And once in a while, if Columbia had a big major production and it had some fabulous sets, they would use those sets and create a story around the set.
I know as far as material as well, Joan, that with all their years in vaudeville, they'd learned so many routines, and whenever something seemed like it would fit into one of the shorts, they'd just kind of take that out of the trunk and perform it as part of the short, and I love that kind of stuff. So it's always fun to see them do the various things, like the guy wearing the three watches. And how do you tell time with it? Well, the first watch is 2 hours fast every 3 hours. The second watch runs slow every 5 hours, and the one in the middle is stopped. And Mo asks Larry, well, what time is it? Larry takes off his hat, takes out a pocket watch, and says, oh, it's 2:30.
Yeah, that was always a great deal. So, now I have photographs of them, I think, doing some of that stuff.
So, Rich, are you saying that they reused bits from short to short? Are you kidding me?
No, actually, and that's one of the great things. They could always kind of revitalize things.
Yeah, they did a lot.
And
yeah.
I have to say, that's a way that it educated a lot of us to a lot of vaudeville stuff that never, would ever be seen if it wasn't immortalized on film.
So true. So true. And I think this would be a surprising fact for some people is that they did a short. I don't know if it was the third one, maybe Men in Black. Was that when they were Dr.
Yeah.
Fine, Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Howard, Dr. Fine, Dr.
Yeah.
Howard?
Yes.
That they were nominated for an Oscar, for an Academy Award. I mean, I think that would surprise some people, Joan.
Yeah, that was that was wonderful. My dad got such pleasure out of that. Because being kind of lowbrow comedy, they didn't get the accolades the other comedy teams received. Not until 1983.
Yeah,
you know, that's
right.
Funny because they lost to, I believe, Disney's Three Little Pigs. So it was still three, but it was the wrong three that got the award.
Oh, is that how it goes? They lost. But they were nominated. Hey, they were nominated. You know, they were doing pretty well at the time, and I know this doesn't sound like much when I mention this, but they were splitting about $7,500 per short, which was, you know, when you look at today's prices, it would be about $140,000 a short. So each guy got, you know, $45,000. Not too bad. And, you know, especially when you think about how many shorts they produced a year. Was it 8? Was it 10? How many did they do a year, Joan?
It was 8 shorts a year, and Columbia, in their contract, allowed them to do 14 weeks of vaudeville, and that augmented their salary. So they came up pretty good there. I'm not quite certain about, well, was the $7,500 for a short or per week?
What my research was per short.
Yeah, because then maybe that would have fit the bill. Okay.
Yeah, and you know what? Here's the thing, too. I'm assuming that when they toured around, did they do that on behalf of the studio to promote the shorts, or was that just their way to do, like comedians do today, like going and doing stand-up and performing in clubs and that type of thing?
Yeah, they wanted to do that. My father liked to keep busy. Columbia didn't share in any of that money at all, and I'm sure in Harry Cohn's head, he figured, gee, this would be good as, letting another audience see their stooges.
Sure.
And I remember seeing some pictures of them also doing USO tours at that time.
Right. That would have been during the war, which would have been...
I saw some military pictures.
40s,
of, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing a great picture of the three of them just surrounded by military guys.
That's cool.
Doing a show, and it was just so neat to see that.
Yeah. That's very cool. Yeah. When we come back, we'll talk about the 14 successful years with Mo, Larry, and Curly, the health issues that led to his early retirement, that's Curly, and his older brother Shemp's return to the act. All next on 720 WGN.
Ready, sister? Let's get that junk out of here. Come on, boys. Scram. I'll give you the idea in a nutshell. B-A, bay. B-E-B. B-I, bicky bye. B-O, bo. I'll give you the correct demonstration. Cutie pie, pound those horse teeth.
B-A, bay, B-E-B, B-I, bicky bye, B-O, bo, bicky bye, bo, B-U, boo, bicky bye, bo, boo.
C-H-A, C-E-C, C-I, sicky sigh, C-O, so, sicky sigh, so, C-U, soo, sicky sigh, so, soo.
Get the idea, girls? Now we'll all join together on the letter D.
D-A, day, D-E-D.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking about the 80th anniversary of the legendary Three Stooges with Mo Howard's daughter, Joan Marr, and Three Stooges aficionado, Chicago's very own, Rich Coates.
Now, see, Dave, you know the local TV station that also owns this company uses Chicago's very own. Yeah, I don't want to get sued, so would you knock that
you'll
off?
You'll be hearing from our lawyers on Monday.
Thanks a lot.
So tell me a little bit about your Uncle Babe, who was Curly, Jerry. You know, he had a bunch of nicknames. Tell me a little bit about Babe.
Let's see. We never called him Curly. Even though he was Uncle Curly or Jerry, I called him what my dad called him, which was Babe. He was the baby in the family, so I called him Uncle Babe. And he was quiet and shy in a family setting. I think my dad must have read him the riot act because...
he had a mouth on him, didn't he?
Yeah, he certainly did. And, my dad must have said to him, look, you can't do those things in front of the girls. So you better calm down. So there was no real communication. Just hiya, Joni, and my brother Paul would say, hiya, Polly boy. And he'd proceed to, he loved dogs. He had to give them away when he went on tour. But he loved to swim. He'd jump in our pool doing a comedy diving. And when he would, you know, he was pretty heavy. And when he landed in the water doing like a cannonball, half the water would come out of the pool. But as I said, he dressed beautifully, always wore a hat, I guess to cover the bald head. Mm-hmm. Of course, he didn't wear the hat in the pool. But
he didn't like having the bald head, did he? He did. That was for the shtick, but he didn't like it.
Yeah, he didn't care for it at all. And also, he had a wonderful sense of timing. In nightclubs, he'd grab the bass from the club's bass player. Great sense of rhythm, And one of the funny things he used to do, he'd take the tablecloth in the restaurant if he had gone out to dinner, and he'd rip it to the time, to the, to, you know, the beat of the music. So if you sat at a table near his, it was really a blast.
I bet.
I wonder how many tablecloths he had to pay for along the way.
Oh, right. I think that would be on his bill. I remember seeing that.
That's funny. Well, he played the spoons. I mean, he seemed like he was the life of the party when he was on Public. You said he was a little quiet at home, which, again, you've always read with comedians and stuff that that, you know, they're a little quieter. You know, they're on when they're in front of people. They're on when they're in front of an audience. But when it's kind of behind closed doors, it's, you know, they're off. They shut it off.
I guess they have to. It's exhausting.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. And he was obviously, you know, one of the most popular, at least of the third, between Curly and Shemp and, of course, the Joes. But, you know, it was his childlike humor. You know, it was like watching a little kid, his silly verbal expressions, his mannerisms that made people laugh. But you always thought you were associating with, like, a little boy. I mean, that was his shtick.
A lot of the fans related to that. In fact, there was one fan, and I'll never forget what he said in this letter. He says, when you hear Curly, yuck, yuck, it's like a mating call for the true believers.
Oh, nice. I think that's true. Well, I mean, he came up with all those lines and all the, I mean, it's just, it was things you expected. And it's kind of like when you got through watching one of the shorts and you didn't see something that you really liked, you'd be bummed a little bit. Like, well, how come he didn't, you know, walk backwards in his little skip thing? And why don't you, you know, why didn't he poke him in the eye? What, you know, it was funny because in the younger days, they were obviously a little bit more animated, but I mean, just like everybody else, they got a little older and things changed.
One thing that I've always noticed, Joan, and every one of his little reactions always made sense. It always seemed like it was a natural reaction, and I could get some flack for this, but when you watch Lou Costello, a lot of times you can tell he's throwing things in just trying to get a laugh, but it doesn't seem like it's part of the natural flow of what he's doing. Yet with Curly, it always was. Even little ad-libbed reactions always seemed like they were right in character, and it seemed like he was just reacting on the spot, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's just so great in these charts.
Yeah, my dad felt he was a genius, and I think the short where he's having the oyster stew really showed up his reactions to things that were happening.
Yeah.
The frustration when he couldn't get that little oyster out of the soup, and he banged down in anger with his fork. You really believed that was going on, that insanity.
You know, I remember that short, and the camera really just stayed on him for quite some time. I always thought that was very interesting, that the focus was just on him, that bowl of soup. But it was great from a direction standpoint, because you were so focused on everything he did, and it was hysterical.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. But now, you know, he and his and Mo and Larry, they spent 10 years together at Columbia before his health began to deteriorate. And I remember this was about, it was really the last 3 years he was with the boys. It was 1944. His actions were slower. His voice had changed. He always looked like he had a frown on his face. I know you wrote in your book that Harry Cohn, who was the head of Columbia, really refused to not let him take a lot of time off when Mo asked him, you know, my brother needs a little break. And it really just got worse.
Yeah, I know during that period, some people felt that he might have had a series of mini strokes before the big one. And then looking through the Columbia stills, it was really weird. I noticed the blank, lifeless look on his usually very animated face.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, this feeling of things really happening. There was nothing there.
Yeah. And so it was Half-Wit's Holiday, which would be Curly's final appearance as an official member of the Stooges. It was a remake of the comedy Hoi Polloi, which the premise, again, was about society and, you know, becoming more respectable in society.
Right, finding a way to turn these three Stooges into wonderful society-bred gentlemen,
exactly.
Which didn't quite work exactly.
And it was February 6, 1947. He suffered a severe stroke while sitting in the director's chair. So, Rich, he wasn't on set at the time.
Yeah, he wasn't in the scene that was being shot, and then it was time for him to come to get onto the soundstage. He didn't answer, and Mo went looking for him, and he found Curly with his head just drooping down on his chest, and his mouth was distorted. He was unable to speak, and I remember in your dad's autobiography talking about the fact that he just had tears running down his face, and Mo quietly alerted Jules White to it, and they immediately got him some medical help, and the boys just finished the scene as quickly as possible. That's why in that short, in the big pie fight at the end, Curly is nowhere in evidence because he had to be taken away to the hospital. And then right after that, Mo rushed to the hospital to join him. And that was very sad. It's a terrible thing that, you know, all of a sudden he just disappeared from that short and really from the Stooges team for the most part.
Shemp took over, which was supposed to be temporary, but obviously it was permanent. And Curly appeared in 14 movies, which I don't think people know. They only remember the shorts, but there were some full theatrical movies, but then there was also ones that he just, you know, made appearances in with the boys. 97 Columbia shorts. And then when he was retired already, Joan, he appeared one time only with Mo and Shemp and Larry. One time that they were all on set. It was the only time. It was a Shemp short called Hold That Lion.
I remember seeing that short. That was really very interesting to see the three brothers together.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the boys are on the train trying to find the guy that double-crossed him. Maybe it was Mr. Slip. And as they're going along...
Isn't that all of them?
Yeah, probably so. And they're checking out all these passengers. There's one guy who's got his face covered with a newspaper. They figure, well, this has got to be him. They take it off, and it's Curly with much longer hair than we ever saw him with on screen. He has a clothespin on his nose. And when,
skinnier.
When they take the clothespin off his nose, he starts snoring and adding in like woo-woo-woo and ruff, ruff type noises. And I remember, I think Shep says something like, yeah, I think he's a Cocker Spaniel or something like that. Yeah.
And Mo said, no, he's just a Spaniel.
Yeah, he's just a Spaniel.
Which I never understood.
I know.
What that meant. But I need an encyclopedia just to understand some of the, the silliness.
You know, they did so many ad-libs. But that was so great to be able to see the brothers together all at once on screen.
And I think there was one more
time. I think they wanted to build up his feeling that he would come back someday.
Yeah.
But he did another one, too. It was never released. I've seen still pictures of it. But he was in one more short when they were doing some Arabian Nights scene.
I saw a still on that.
Yeah.
He's a cook, and he's got a knife in his hand, and a big mustache, and he's side view. But I recognized his ear. He has the same ears my dad had.
And the one thing that I noticed in that still, again, it's the film footage must have been lost, but he seemed extremely thin in that picture.
That could be.
He
had a chef's coat on the one that I saw, and the fact it was side view, I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
But there could be other stills.
But, I mean, what's so sad is that it was 1952. He died at 49 years old. I mean, just so young to be gone so quickly.
Right. Yeah. I said wine, women, and song.
Yeah.
Did him in.
He lived a long life in a short 49 years, didn't he?
Right.
Yeah. Well, Shemp wasn't Curly, and, you know, there's fans that love Curly, there's fans that love Shemp. And, you know, he gets a short end of the stick, but I really thought he was funny in his own way. He just wasn't Curly, but, man, I tell you, there were some episodes that his facial expressions, you know, he used to call himself the, you know, I'm the ugliest man in Hollywood, you know, but hysterical.
Yeah, he was great. I really enjoy watching him. He does some really off-the-wall ad-libs like we were talking about, and you can tell when he's just pulling stuff out of the air, and it's so funny. And his character of a sort of cowardly smart aleck who still always gets his comeuppance from Mo as the leader of the group seemed to just mesh so well with the team. He was actually a very, very funny guy, and people always say, oh, he's always, you know, pushing his hair back behind his ears and all this stuff, and I'm like, what does that have to do with it? You just watch the stuff he's doing, and he's so funny.
My dad worked all his life to make the Stooges work, and I feel like I picked up that torch, and hopefully I can help.
And I think, Joan, that it must be so gratifying to you to see that they're still just so popular today. I mean, our Stoogepalooza show runs in prime time on a Saturday night, and new generations keep discovering them, and just... it shows that their humor is timeless, and it's just a credit to their memory.
Well, anyway, my dad would have been absolutely thrilled. He was interviewed years ago, and somebody said to him, how long do you think the Stooges are going to last? And with a twinkle in his eye, he said, well, with a little bit of luck, maybe forever.
Yeah, I think he's right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Adios.
All right. Bye-bye. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Loan me 50 cents, Lou.
Yeah, but I would like to loan you 50 cents, but I can't do it. All I got is 40 cents.
40 cents?
Yeah.
Well, all right. Give me the 40 cents, and you owe me 10 cents.
Right.
All right?
Wait a minute.
What's the matter?
How come I owe you 10 cents?
What did I ask you for?
50 cents.
And what'd you give me?
40 cents.
So you owe me 10 cents.
How could I owe you 10 cents?
Now, wait a minute. Listen.
I gave you all that money I had in my pocket. I gave you 40 cents.
Argue with me again?
No, I got to owe you 10 cents besides.
I asked you for 50 cents.
Well, all I had was 40 cents. And
so
I
you owe me 10 cents.
How could I owe you 10 cents?
Take it easy. Take it easy. 40 cents and 10 cents is how much?
That's, everybody knows that.
It's 50 cents.
Oh, no. 25 and 25 is 50 cents.
Give me that. All right, here's your 40 cents. Give me back the dime you owe me.
Okay, now we're even.
Now we're even.
Okay.
That's my own fault for asking you for a loan of 50 cents.
You tricked me too much into this.
I shouldn't ask you for 50 cents.
How come I loan you 50 cents? Well, all I got left now is 30 cents.
Now loan me the 30 cents and you owe me 20.
Okay.
Now, no arguments. Now everything's all right. You owe me 20 cents.
Hmm.
Now make it, it's clear to you, am I right?
How can I owe you 20 cents now?
So Abbott and Costello were one of the greatest comedy teams in the history of show business. They mastered the straight man clown relationship, creating a magical chemistry that would take them from the burlesque stage to radio to Broadway to film and finally to television. Abbott and Costello first appeared on stage together at New York's Eltinge Burlesque Theater in 1935. There's one film that really stands out, especially this time of year, and that is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And joining Rich and I to talk about Abbott and Costello, Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein, and so much more, is the daughter of Lou Costello, and that is his daughter, Chris. Chris, it's been a while. So glad you're joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's really good to be with you guys.
I had the pleasure of sitting with you and your sister at the Radio Hall of Fame 10 years ago. It was actually this month. We inducted your dad. That was 10 years ago.
Was that the one in Chicago?
That was the one in Chicago.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a while ago. It was a while ago. Now, you know, I know, and I don't know how many people really know this, but your dad was so very young when he passed away at the age of 52, and you were just 11 years old. So I know you don't know a lot of the stories firsthand, but you wrote a great book. I know you've done so much research on your dad and his legacy. It was Lose On First was the name of the book. But tell me a little bit about your dad, you know, growing up in New Jersey, like his early days.
Well, first of all, a lot of that information, you know, I always got from, you know, his mother, my grandmother, you know, the relatives in the family, and also himself, because even though I only had him for 11 years, boy, there are so many memories attached within those 11 years, which I would say I'm quite fortunate. I feel blessed. But his early years in Patterson, my grandma, I remember her sitting at the table, you know, with a cup of coffee and talking, just reminiscing. And she would say that he was always very, very comical, even as a kid. He would do funny things like ride the banister from the top floor down to the lower floor, backwards, and then she would be screaming, "You're going to break your head," and he would all of a sudden just do a somersault and land on a seat. She said that he loved Charlie Chaplin. That was his idol. I think Charlie Chaplin was really the motivating force within Dad to want to become not a comic, but an actor. So he always associated Chaplin more as an actor. And she said, I remember at the Armory, which is where he also played his basketball, they were having a Halloween contest, and he dressed himself up like Chaplin. She said, I had no idea that he was going to be coming as Chaplin, but I was in the audience, and, you know, I saw them announce his name because it was a contest, and down the aisle comes this person that looks just like Chaplin. He had the moves. He was twirling the cane. He was doing all the side, you know, stuff. And she said it was only when they announced him as the winner and he finally said who he was, she said, I almost fell off the chair.
That's awesome.
So he just really, he always had that ability in him. I think it's something he was never trained in. It was just a natural instinctive ability he had. But she would also tell, like, when he was with the Armory Five, he played like a Harlem Globetrotter because he was so short. And he would be bouncing the ball and literally going between the legs of the opponents. And doing these twirls, and he could shoot a perfect basket.
Well, it always seemed to me that he really was so athletic and so good at moving. His moves were incredible. It was like he was an acrobat at times.
He was. He was. He knew. He, you know, I get a lot of, you know, the Facebook, and we've almost got 5,000 members, but people will ask me, you know, did he ever get bruised up when he was working? And I would say no. I mean, he really knew how to use his body. He knew how to use it very well, but also, you know, there was sound effects that were also put into, you know, to make it appear even more real. But he was just very agile with his body, you know, very agile. I can remember at the ranch, my God, he would, you know, come in from the studio, and one of his things he liked to do, I'll never forget this, he would change into like a pair of shorts and a pool top. He'd have a baseball cap on. He'd go to the refrigerator. He'd get a piece of Swiss cheese, get some crackers, start walking down towards the barn where he had a hoop, you know, a basketball hoop, and he would get a ball, and he would just, you know, dribble that ball, and all of a sudden he would turn and throw it over his head, and I swear to God, it went into the basket.
That's amazing.
He was, well, and here come the co-eds, his film with that one, Peggy Ryan. All of the baskets are shot, that are being shot off camera. That's him.
Oh, wow.
That was not, yeah, he was doing all of those shots. I think the first stunt work was on a horse, and they said, do you know how to ride? And he said, yes. And I thought, ride? You know, just from Patterson, New Jersey.
From Jersey, yeah.
Yeah,
you know? Exactly.
But my sister can tell the story of, I guess the horse took off, and his saddle, which was not on secure, I guess it rotated on the horse. So he was literally riding on the side of a horse.
Oh, man.
He stayed on. So,
Wow. Well, I mean, it's so cool, you know, as you talk about this in his early days trying to make it, you know, he finally paired up with Bud Abbott in 1935 at New York's Elton Burlesque Theater. So that was the first time they kind of performed together. They met. They were both performing there at the same time. But their official teaming, I know, was in 36, where they started touring and getting on the air. And I know Kate Smith's Radio Hour was that first really big break for them, was appearing on that show and doing Who's On First.
Well, it was sort of a ploy with Dad that he really had so much faith in this routine. And I believe it was Ted Collins, the producer, who, first of all, said to him, one of you has got to start altering the voice, because with the radio audience, they can only hear. They can't see who's who.
True.
And so that's when Dad, of course, started to raise his voice, doing the little boy sort of register, I'm a bad boy was coined, stuff like that, and the Hey Abbott. But they really wanted to put Who's On First on the air, and Ted Collins wouldn't let them. He said, it's just, it's too visual a piece. It's not going to go. It's not going to fly. And so Dad had said to Ted Collins, he said, and this was right before going on the air, he said, well, we've exhausted all of the routines. And he said, you know, we're just not going to be able to go on tonight. We have no material. And Ted Collins got so nervous and then got really upset. And he looked at him and he said, do anything. I don't care. Do that baseball routine. Just get out there and do something. And they did. And that's what launched him into Hollywood.
I scared you.
Yes.
Ah, I scared you, you big sissy. This is your mask.
Mine?
Come
here. Oh, no, no. Please don't wear that.
What's the matter?
I know you think I'm crazy, but in a half an hour, the moon will rise, and I'll turn into a wolf.
You and 20 million other guys.
Now, Who's On First, Rich, just a little explanation for those who might have not heard it, because we're going to play a little clip, but explain a little bit about what that's all about.
Well, they're talking about, you know, that Lou would love to be a baseball player, and he's a pretty good baseball player. He'd like to be on the team, and Bud says, well, you know, we've got a really good team so far, and he starts to name the different players who are on their different positions,
right.
And it's names that are very confusing, because he says, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third, and, you know, so Lou's trying to figure this out.
Yeah,
so he's trying to figure out, you know, what's the guy on first? And he's like, no, no, who's the guy on first? And it's just such a great wordplay sketch, and I know a lot of people have tried to imitate it and tried to write one similar, but That one is just so perfect, and it still, every time I hear it, it makes me laugh.
Let's take a listen.
Now, you got to tell me the names of the fellows on the team so when I want to say hello to them.
I told you before, Lou, they all have very strange names.
All right, now who's on first?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who is on first?
Why do you keep asking me?
I'm not asking you, I'm telling you.
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's right.
Go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
That's the man's name.
Now look, when you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. And why not? After all, the man's entitled to it.
Who's entitled to it?
Certainly.
Well, who gets the money?
Every dollar. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes.
So they signed to Universal in 1939. They were really the new kings of comedy. Solid, you know, decade of box office hits. They essentially saved Universal Pictures at the time. I mean, they were a struggling company.
Yeah, they were. Well, it was a B studio back then. It wasn't what it is today. In fact, Universal was a studio that Louis B. Mayer used to threaten to loan his stars to if they got out of line. But it's true. Dan and Bud did save Universal. They definitely took them, you know, up a few notches. But then after the era of Abbott and Costello, it was also Donald O'Connor with Francis the Talking Mule, you know, that helped to keep the studio going.
But at some point, they offered your dad the opportunity, these guys, to buy the studios at that point, because they were making a lot of money. I know they were making like 10% of the gross, which was kind of unheard of at the time. I mean, wow. they were making big money.
They were. And, you know, again, I don't know if a lot of that was just sort of a little bit of a story that became a rumor. I could never find anything that really leaned towards the fact that, yes, Universal had, in fact, offered the studio to Abbott and Costello. You know, Dad, if he had listened, I think, to his father, my grandfather, and maybe even my mother, who was a Scot, he would get into these investments. Oh, my Lord. You know, like backing every inventor, you know, in L.A. that came up with an invention. My sister would say, we had equipment at the house. He had a hot dog machine that would you know, rotate stale hot dogs, and ice cube machines that would spit ice at you. And,
it's very,
you know,
Ralph Cramden. Very Ralph Cramden.
Dad, how's the oil well doing? When's the oil coming in, Dad? Well, when the snow clears. Snow clears, it's in Arizona, you know.
That's awesome.
So, but yeah, he loved gadgets. Anything that was gadget-oriented, he loved it. And if he were here today, man, he would have all the high-tech stuff.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about their movies, but not only did he put money into these gadgets and stuff, but he also was very charitable. And I know you were talking about This Is Your Life. This is a show that was airing in the 50s and 60s where they would bring somebody out and they would really kind of walk you through, and your mom would be there and the family and everybody who touched your life in some way. And you talked about him playing basketball at the Armory with the Armory Five. They were all there. But it was all about him also giving back to the community. I mean, your dad was a very charitable guy.
You know, there was an expression I often heard, and people would refer to him as having, what is it, long arms, short pockets. He was always like that. You know, even my grandmother said it as a kid. He was always like doing something for the orphanage kids. You know, that was just who he was. But I also heard stories from people who have written me over the years saying, I remember as a kid, your dad in Omaha, Nebraska during the War Bond tour. And a friend of mine said he didn't have any money, but if there was any way he could come to his house, you know, and Dad and Bud would go to the kid's house and in the backyard perform for free.
Wow.
You know, for these people.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that's the image that I like promoting of my dad, because that's really who he was. This wasn't somebody who was doing it for the press. He did it because he genuinely loved people.
Now, the movies themselves, you know, they were a box office just smash for decades. Buck Privates was really the movie that launched their career.
Definitely so. And of course, it had along with it the Andrews sisters, who were very popular at the time. And when we were showing Hold That Ghost, I brought up the fact that they actually held off on releasing Hold That Ghost because Buck Privates was such a big hit, and they were worried that some of the audiences might not accept them if it wasn't another service comedy. So they did. I think it was In the Navy was next, maybe, and mm-hmm. then they reshot parts of Hold That Ghost to include the Andrews sisters, so that they could, you know, have that link kind of going through all of the movies.
And that's because they saw the popularity of the content of what that first movie was all about.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Well, all of the studios though back then were doing the war films, and so I think Universal again saw the commodity in taking Abbott and Costello into you know, the Keep 'Em Flying, the Army, and Buck Privates in the Navy. And in fact, it's very funny within the Navy, in the scene where you see all the battleships mm-hmm. out there in the water, and you see when Dad was the captain of one of the battleships, you know, he was crisscrossing between them all. The U.S. Navy made them take that scene out because it made the Navy look like fools. And
oh,
so then they took that and they recreated it into a dream sequence of him, you know, in the Admiral's outfit and this and that.
But didn't that tell you how respected they were?
Those little miniatures, the battleships, those were all like on a backlot tank.
Sure.
So they were built as miniatures. Those were in our pool.
That's cool. But I mean, that must have just sent a message on how popular they were, that they were concerned about the image of the Navy, that so many people were going to go see this movie, that we got to make sure they change it because, you know, again, they were the two of the most respected comedians in comedy and in the movies at the time.
Well, that's true. But also, you know, in Buck Privates, you know, the drill routine,
mm-hmm.
The Japanese government started showing that clip to their armies to show them how ridiculous the American Army was.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
A good motivational film. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, one of my favorites, and of course, in my children's favorites, so for so many reasons, it was the rare pairing at the time of comedy and horror starring Abbott and Costello in the original Universal Monsters, which was Bela Lugosi as Dracula, Lon Chaney as the Wolfman, Glenn Strange as Frankenstein. Rich, I know it's one of your favorites as well, but it was, you know, just about a decade and a half ago, the United States Library of Congress said it was a film that was culturally historical, aesthetically significant, and was selected for preservation from the National Film Registry.
You know, the monsters at that time had pretty much run their course, and, you know, they weren't really making that many of those, you know, classic horror movies anymore with those characters. And the idea of pairing him with Bud and Lou seems ingenious. I think originally it was going to be Brain of Frankenstein. It was just going to be, I believe, a sequel to Ghost of Frankenstein. And then somebody came up with that idea of putting them together. Now, Chris, I had heard that they originally were going to do this as a Broadway show, kind of, with Abbott and Costello Meet the Monsters. Was that true?
I had no idea about that one. That's the first I've heard of that. No,
okay.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, and just the fact that, you know, it was the perfect pairing. And I just remember you telling me a story, in fact, via email, about how you were 1 year old and came to the set and had a kind of strange meeting with Glenn Strange.
Well, no, I was a year old, and my mother had brought me onto the set. And course, I don't remember this, but my sister was telling me, she said, and Patty is 11 years older, so she had perfect recall. She said, Mom took you to the set, and she said, Glenn Strange, who played Frankenstein, loved kids, absolutely loved kids. And I guess when he saw me come in my mother's arms, he got up from his chair full of makeup, came walking towards me with his arms outstretched, saying, come to Uncle Glenn. She said, with that, you let out the most blood-curdling scream. And Dad was just, get her out of here. Get her out of here.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Now, I know that film was probably one of the most memorable films for an Abbott and Costello fan, but it was your father's least favorite. Why was that?
I think back then, and God knows, you know, if he'd lived, you know, longer, how he would feel about it now, but I think back then he felt that Universal had lost faith in them carrying a film, that they needed to put all these monsters in this film with them to lend box office draw. So he went into this film basically not really liking it. And there was probably nothing you could say to him that would make him change his mind. He, according to Charlie Barton, the director, who became a dear friend after I interviewed him, he would chuckle and he'd say, your dad would walk up to the big boys in the big office and he'd slam the script on the desk saying, my three-year-old could write a better script than this. you know, so I think it was just his gripe was with the studio, thinking they had felt in their heads that they had run their course with Abbott and Costello. They weren't box office draws like they were in there. Let's draw these monsters in this film. You know, it became a cult classic, you know. But I know my grandmother said that when she went to the premiere, that she said, I remember going up to the producer and saying, this is one of the funniest Abbott and Costello films I've ever seen. And he turned and looked at her and walked away and wouldn't talk to her for a week.
But you know what? I think when you make a film that's seasonal, like if it's a Christmas movie, it's a Halloween movie, it really, that's what really lifts that picture up into the spotlight where generations of fans see it really because of that reason. And this one was a standout.
Well, I think, too, you know, is that if he had lived longer, if he had been able to see how it just generated such a new legion of fans around the world, I truly think he would have changed his mind. I think it was, at the time, it was just something that just did not sit right with him. And again, I think it was more towards Universal, you know, losing faith in them. You know, which they didn't, but, you know, it was, I think they were just trying to see how they could incorporate, you know, all these monsters with Abbott and Costello and put a comedy twist to it versus a horror twist.
Very cool. Very cool. And, of course, Abbott and Costello, the Abbott and Costello show airs on MeTV as well. And if you want to find out more, as Chris said, about Abbott and Costello, check out the Facebook page, Who's On First, and the product page, Abbott and Costello Collectibles.com. Chris, really appreciate you spending some time with us tonight.
Well, anytime. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was fun.